Nevertheless, there is a rule against such admission, and only very special reasons: my age, the studies I was pursuing, and, above all, powerful protection, procured me this privilege. For more than 2 years I translated Tibetan books in the celebrated monastery of Kembumi Namdo, in the northeast of Tibet, beyond the great desert of grass. There, seated on my balcony, on certain evenings, I could hear the Lama's orchestra playing on the roof terrace of the great assembly hall. The concert was being given to the gods. It was they, the invisible ones, whom it was desired to charm, attract, cause for a moment to rest, and smile among their younger brothers, the humans. What was asked of them? Nothing, nothing but to take pleasure in the music of our world. This was charming in its infantile poetry, and what miscreant would have dared to doubt that the light-footed goddesses did not brush over our dwellings, hastening toward the sweet strains that called them? Meanwhile, in the vast edifice scarcely lighted by the lamps placed before the magnificent tombs and gilded statues of defunct lamas, the monks were seated motionless, attired in dark crimes and togas. They were chanting in deep tones solemn sentences of mystic import or transcendental philosophy, which raised the mind above captivating illusions. Above them, the last notes of the bewitching melodies melted away, and soon the recitation of the sacred writings itself came to an end. A rapid gesture, symbolizing the void, brought the Vesper service to its close, and each Lama returned to his own abode. However great the charms of the studious life I led at Kumdum, and of the romantic surroundings in which I dwelt, they could not efface or lessen the impression made upon me by certain simple gompas, offering none of the splendors of the wealthy monastic city of Amdo. One of these was perched like an eyrie, upon a mountain spur surrounded by forests. The villages, planted in the depths of the valleys, remained invisible from the monastery, and all around it was silence and solitude. There one could behold no princely palace, no temple crammed with ancient treasures. Some whitewashed cabins made of branches and clay served as dwellings for the humble lamas of this rustic hermitage. The configuration of the surrounding mountain ranges arrested the passage of the clouds, and forced them to turn round the rocky summit which supported the gompa, forming a sea of white mist, with its waves beating silently against the cells of the monks, breathing the wooded slopes and creating a thousand fanciful landscapes as they rolled by. Terrible hailstorms would often break over the monastery, due, said the country folk, to the malignity of the demons who sought to disturb the peace of the saintly monks. The sight lent itself admirably to the fearful imaginings of occult forces, and of those singular encounters with beings of other worlds. According to old traditions, gods and devils haunted the neighboring forests, and for this reason gompshans bury themselves in their depths, in pursuit of ends known only to themselves. I had my hut there, a tiny dwelling under the giant trees. The lamas built it for me, partly out of respect, but partly also, doubtless, from a spice of mischief, desiring to test my courage and see whether I dared to rival their mystics by living there alone, in the company of the phantoms. One night a storm of unusual violence overthrew my cell of branches and scattered its covering to the winds of heaven. Knowing the superstitious credulity of my friends the lamas, I insisted that it should be put up again in the same place. If I had left it, they would have been sure to conclude that the incensed deities had driven away the stranger who had been rash enough to establish herself in their district, and for me all chance of further study would have been lost. The hut having been rebuilt, I had brought there a store of provisions to last a month, and expressly forbade anybody to visit my quarters for that length of time. My days passed peacefully, in company with the birds, which did not appear at all disturbed by my presence. Some rose came to look at me, and one day a big bear appeared, seemingly much surprised to find me there. Thus, in reading, musing, and cooking my soul daily repast, I awaited the end of my retreat. Spring was at hand. When the lamas came back to seek me, they found flowers growing around my dwelling, and I myself was flourishing. They thought I had overcome the dread forces, and the respect they manifested for me was enormously enhanced. Later on, I lived in another more remote hermitage close to the everlasting snows, and that time a prolonged stay of several years acquainted Ma with the secrets and the bliss of the Tibetan Gompenza life. How many of these desert monasteries I could describe? I am thinking of one of them, a nunnery, isolated in the midst of rocks and glaciers, access to which is possible only during the 4 months from June to September. After this short summer, the barrier of snow is raised once more and the recluses are immured for the rest of the year. Yet the Gompa, however far it may be from the bustle and activity of the village, fails to satisfy the exacting mysticism of Tibetan thinkers. Farther in the deserts, higher still on their giant beaks, they seek caves and almost inaccessible shelters, where they may meditate and be ever alone, face to face with the infinite and the eternal. The holiest temple of Tibet, which I went to see after my visit at the Potala, is called Jokhang, the House of the Lord. It was built to shelter an ancient image of Siddhartha Gautama as a youth, before he became a Buddha. That image was made in India and is supposed to have been carried to China about the 1st century BC. The Chinese emperor, Taiyong Taitse, gave it as a dowry to his daughter when she married the Tibetan king, Srung Tsangampo. Amongst the credulous Tibetans, many legends circulate about the image and its origin. Many say that it was self-created, and it is firmly believed to have spoken on several occasions. Beside the Jawo, Lord, altar in front of which burn thousands of lamps, there are, in the temple, a large number of rooms that contain images of deities and of holy men. A strange sight is the crowd of pilgrims perambulating silently in the dark, windowless edifice between these motionless personages, many of which are life-size. The yellowish light of the Buddha lamp adds to the strangeness of the spectacle. From a distance it is sometimes difficult to distinguish the living beings from the host of dummies who receive their homage. Footnote. The path leading to the hermitage where I stayed was also blocked from the middle of December to April. This is a common thing with anchorites' dwellings in Tibet. Although the statues are of no artistic interest whatever, one receives a deep impression from those many faces, immutably serene, whose gaze seems fixed on some inward object and which tell of a mystic method that establishes the mind in an everlasting calm. I felt saddened at beholding the procession of worshippers, lost in superstition and exactly following the path that was condemned by the very one whose memory they worship. Beings led by ignorance, who tramp for fathomless ages the sorrowful road to renewed births and deaths, as the Buddhist scriptures say. However, the many sacristans and sextons, who, wrapped in their darker togas, are conspicuous everywhere in the temple, do not find any cause for sadness in the affluence of pilgrims. It is all profit to them, for they allow themselves a large share in the offerings of the faithful. They can be seen watching the crowd, ready to seize upon those who appear the richest or the most devout, from whom the biggest gratuities may be expected. As soon as the little group of pilgrims or the lone devotee is in their power, there is no end to the wonders they are led to witness. The holy relics that are placed for a second on their heads, the holy water that they are made to drink from various gold and silver pots, the stories that they must hear. And invariably an offering is requested by the comrades of the guide in charge of the various shrines. I humbly confess that, as it could not have been my wealthy appearance which attracted these cunning fellows, it must have been my air of profound stupidity, for I was quickly provided with several uncalled for guides, who took me into the most remote corners of the edifice, exhibiting a lot of articles of piety. I might have thought I was back in European Rome with its greedy sacristans. I was again mistaken for a Ladakhi. As I walked around the shrine, trying to avoid tasting of holy water once more, I had been sufficiently refreshed by previous draughts, I heard behind me a compassionate voided. "Oh," said someone, "give only water to that poor woman who has come from Ladakh, so far away. How great is her faith." This time it was not the desire for money, but kind feelings, which prompted the lamas. I saw young and smiling faces around me. A man took hold of my arm and guided me to the proper place, while others pushed away the pilgrims in front of us. I could now admire, close to, more gems, more golden and silver ornaments. A jeweled pot was bent toward my hands, which I extended in the orthodox fashion. Wet me drink and wet my head. I thought, this is my baptism as a Ladakhi. I had a happy inspiration when I chose the beginning of the year for my stay at Lhasa, for at any other time it would not have been possible for me to see so many strange festivals and interesting ceremonies. Mingling with the crowds of holiday makers, I saw cavalcades of gentlemen richly attired in the style of past ages, and cavalry and the infantry of the ancient kings, in their coats of mail, bearing shields and bucklers, recalling the Tibet of former days. There was a certain amount of horse racing. It was disorderly, mad, joyous, and amusing, but not to be compared, from the point of view of horsemanship, with that of the Dokpas in the desert of grass. On several occasions I saw the man who is recognized as the most learned in all the country, and who occupies the throne of Tsongkhapa. Throughout the first month of the year he preaches in the open air, under a canopy erected for this purpose, close to the Jokhang. His audience is not recruited from the crowd, as one might think from the fact that he speaks outside the temple. The monks alone have the right to sit cross-legged on the pavement at his feet, and those who hear the preaching have been chosen by their superiors. They are there by command. Woe to anyone who spoke to his neighbor, and who did not maintain an absolutely motion. The founder of the Gapliuk sect. Literally, the sect of those who have virtuous customs, that known by the Westerners as Yellow Cap sect. Less attitude. Woe also to the unfortunate layman whose religious zeal led him hither to listen to the discourses of the Supreme Master. The clerics acting as police officers for the assembly would soon lash him roughly with the long bundle of ropes they flourish continually in a martial fashion. The great philosopher of Tibet is a spare old man with a thin, angular countenance and the appearance of an aristocratic and haughty ascetic. He walks with short, quick steps beneath the yellow brocaded umbrella of honor which a friar holds over him, as if he were anxious to have done quickly with an annoying duty. The expression stamped on his intelligent face is that of the suppressed boredom of one to whom crowds and public ceremonies are distasteful. Seated upon his throne, he does not preach in the way we understand the word in the West. He speaks without gestures, without raising his voice, with an air of detachment, such as the theories he is explaining demand. The striking contrast afforded by the doctrines expounded by the doctor, together with his refined appearance, and the ignorant, listless crowd, watched by the brutal clerical policemen surrounding him, are well calculated to surprise a stranger, as to Sirti Rinpoche being born, brought up and having grown old in such an environment, he probably does not notice it. The first penetration of Western civilization into Lhasa may be traced in the uniforms of the khaki-clad soldiers. I really enjoyed seeing them, headed by a band which played English tunes not too badly, marching with a swaggering step out of time with the music. They are armed, as has been said before, with old English rifles that are still up to date in most parts of Central Asia, and even possess a few pieces of mountain artillery that are carried by mules. They are immensely proud of the latter and air these short, fat, toad-like weapons in and out of season. One of them burst, killing several men, but the real title is Golden Tepa. He occupies the throne of Golden. That is to say, the throne of Tsongkhapa, founder of the Golden Monastery. No accident did not lessen the admiration that the Lhasapas have for those which remain. In that blessed country, occurrences of that kind are even sometimes believed to be auspicious. In this connection, I can relate an incident which happened during my stay at Lhasa. It is the custom, during the first month of the year, to make mows and to look in many ways for omens regarding the prosperity or ill luck that is to come to the state and especially to the person of the Dalai Lama. One of the omens is obtained in a rather strange way. Three tents are erected, and in each of them an animal is shut, a cock, a goat, and a hare. These beasts have, hung around their necks, charms which have been blessed by the Dalai Lama. A number of men must fire at the tents, and if any of the animals are wounded or killed it means that calamities are awaiting Tibet and its ruler. If this happens, The monks of the three great monasteries, Sera, Golden, and Bipung, must assemble and read the sacred scriptures for 20 days and perform several ceremonies to counteract the ill will of the deities. The year one was at Lhasa, about 25 shots were fired at the tents, instead of 15, which is the usual number. English, Chinese, and Tibetan rifles were used, one of the last burst, and the man who fired it was severely wounded and died the next day. The fact that no tent had been hit, even after that prolonged test, was considered as most auspicious, and the accident that caused the death of the man added greatly to the confidence of the Tibetans regarding the welfare of the Lama king. The unfortunate commoner, they thought, had been taken by some angry demon as a substitute for the most precious existence of the ruler. During the many years I had spent among Tibetans, I had exceptional opportunities of seeing at first hand the life of the different classes of people, but never before had I penetrated so deeply into the intimacy of the common folk as I did during my stay in Lhasa. The hovel in which I had found shelter was the center of a small caravanserai where the strangest specimens of humanity were to be met. The wealthiest guests only slept under a roof, the others remaining in the open. Every act, even every thought, was public. I really lived in a novel whose plot was slum life, but what amusing and exotic slums. They had nothing of the lugubrious physical and mental aspect of those of the West. All were dirty and ragged, food was coarse and often scarce, but everybody enjoyed the great luminous blue sky, and the bright life-giving sun. And waves of joy swept through the minds of these unlucky ones devoid of worldly wealth. No one practiced any trade or craft. They lived, as birds do, on what they could pick up daily. Apart from the acute lack of any comfort, I did not suffer among my strange neighbors. They never suspected who I was, and they treated me with simplicity and kindness as one of themselves. Some had known better days. One was the youngest son of a man who possessed a little wealth. He had married a well-to-do widow much older than himself, and might have prospered, but idleness, drinking, and gambling had ruined him. When his wife had become aged he had taken a mistress, and after a time the legitimate spouse, who realized that she would end in poverty if she kept her unworthy husband, managed to get rid of him in a rather clever way. She called together his and her relatives, and declared her intention of retiring by herself to consecrate her last years to devotion. Her husband, she said, was in love with his mistress. She did not object to their marriage. Polygamy as well as polyandry is legal in Tibet, but they would have to leave her house, to assume all debts that the man had made, and to agree that she was free from any obligation toward her husband. In fact, it was divorce. The man consented, a deed of marriage was drafted, and he went with his new wife. The life of the former lovers was far from being smooth when I happened to make them an acquaintance. The husband was a good-hearted, weak fellow but an inveterate drunkard, who was generally unconscious soon after noon, and so remained until the next morning. The wife, more than once, kept him company. Nevertheless, she was the more active of the pair and of a cleverer turn of mind. Indeed, her cleverness was the subject of tremendous quarrels. The husband asserted that during his prolonged sleep the woman stole his remaining properties, household utensils, blankets, etc. The wife complained that her consort had sold her jewels and gambled with the product. When she raised her voice to a pitch high enough to arouse the drunkard from his stupor, and that feat required strong lungs, a picturesque dialogue followed. Often the man took a heavy stick that he had always at hand, being somewhat crippled by gout, and the lady then received a first-rate bastinado that left her weeping and bruised before anyone had time to come to her help. The room was very small, with only one door on the outside, and the cunning husband, who was a very stout man, always managed to block it with his fat body, a position from which he could reach his old sweetheart with his long stick in whichever corner she ran. The miserable house was divided in three. The entrance room was occupied by the quarreling couple I have just mentioned. I had a narrow cell at one side of it, and a dark room at the back sheltered another most remarkable pair. They also had lived golden days. The housewife's manners were those of a woman of good family. Her husband, who owned some property at the time of their marriage, had been appointed an officer in the Tibetan army during the war with China. Then, as had been the case with his neighbor, gambling and drinking had ruined him. Complete poverty did not, however, abate his pride. He was a very tall, rather handsome man, full of contempt for work, and he assumed the dignified mien of a knight bearing undeserved misfortune. Everybody addressed him with a Tibetan title somewhat corresponding to our captain. To accept a humble job seemed repugnant to the aristocratic feelings of the captain, and the government did not offer him a ministerial seat. He nobly took to the independent profession of begging. Each morning, after drinking his tea, my neighbor went out, Commodore Day courier bag slung over his shoulder and a wallet thrown on it the way that idle goes of your carriage their gape. Staff in hand, he walked, head erect, too conscious of his superiority even to condescend to be arrogant. The captain did not come back home before sunset. He lunched somewhere, taking nobody into his confidence as to the invitations he received. He was witty enough to be pleasant, and enjoyed a kind of celebrity all over Lhasa. People, amused by his manners, gave him what he requested casually, as if the aim of his daily outing was only to call as one gentleman on other gentleman. He succeeded with that method, and his wife and his two children were regularly fed with the contents of the bags he brought back duly filled each evening. The trouble in the drunkard's home grew worse when a turquoise ornament belonging to the housewife disappeared. At first the Nemo accused her husband, but innocence prevailed, and the culprit was discovered in the person of the maid servant, for the lady of the small entrance room had a maid. Now a strange question was raised. The girl pretended she was entitled to an indemnity for having been called a thief. That term of abuse, she said, did not apply to her, because she had not stolen the jewel. She had found it lying on the ground in the room and had picked it up. Men acting as arbiters, as pleaders, as counsels and witnesses, soon filled the house. Some of them had never seen the turquoise locket or the girl, or heard anything connected with the case. They came early in the morning, ate, drank, and stayed late into the evening. From my small quarters I got the full fun of these strange proceedings, and of the peculiar arguments which were put forward, especially at the end of the afternoon, when spirits had infused original ideas into the brains of the assembly. Once, when the discussion had been specially heated, the girl and her former lady began to exchange abuse, and then flew at each other. The men present got up to separate them, a rather hard task, for the infuriated females turned their nails against those who dared to meddle in their duel. Anyhow, they succeeded in pushing the maid out of the house, and, to prevent her from coming back, followed her to the street door across the courtyard. One of those inexplicable thoughts that take possession of drunkards suddenly made the master of the house fix the responsibility of the incident upon his wife. He declared that she had brought shame on him before his guests, and he tried to play his usual trick of standing in the doorway and beating her. But this time, excited by her previous struggle, she flung herself at him and tore his long earring from his ear, which bled. He retaliated by knocking her on the head, and she shrieked loudly. The captain's wife ran out of the room to intervene between them. She had not taken two steps on this Lilliputian battlefield when she received on the cheek a stroke that was not meant for her, and fell on a bench, calling for help. Yongdan being away, I thought it was my duty to prevent the man from seriously hurting his wife, so I walked in with the intention of sheltering the now terrified woman in my room. But people were coming, and escape became possible. Run away quickly, I urged the woman, protecting her retreat. She passed behind me and I never saw her again. When the captain came home that evening, he found his lady with a swollen cheek that had already begun to turn black. To relate the scene that was then enacted with the flame of a brazier for footlights, exceeds my powers of description. The captain had all the manner of a gifted actor. He declaimed half the night, in turn ferocious, clamoring for revenge, then full of pathos, telling of the suffering of his dame. Again, drawn up to his full height, his head nearly touching the low roof, he would speak of the insult done to his honor. The man to whom that rhetoric was addressed lay on the broken couch, more than half unconscious, and the captain, who was himself far from being sober, ended his soliloquy by denouncing the degrading habit of drink. Next day the captain took Yongdan aside and declared his intention of calling me as witness in a suit he meant to bring to obtain damages for his wife's bruised cheek. The young lama tried to persuade him to give up his idea, and offered him a little present. Fei took the money, but remained obstinate. His honor was to be avenged, and I ought to help. When Yongdan reported this conversation to me, I felt very annoyed. I would have to appear before several people eager to hear about the journey of pilgrims who, like us, had visited a large number of holy places. This would mean long talks, and Yongdan and I would of course be questioned about our native land. It might turn out badly for our disguises. We were drinking tea silently, wondering how we could avoid these dangerous meetings, when the door opened. In Tibet, especially among common folk, one does not knock at the door or ask any permission to enter a room or a house. A man stepped in. After the usual polite greetings, he told us that my neighbor, whom I had helped to escape the day before, intended to divorce her husband and wished me to appear as a witness to testify to her husband's brutality. As in the previous case, I endeavored to induce the man to allow me to remain neutral, for both husband and wife had been obliging, and I did not want to say anything against either of them. But persuasion was useless, and he retired saying that he would insist upon my evidence being heard. We thus decided to leave Lhasa for a week, ostensibly for the sake of visiting the great monastery of Golden, where reposes the massive gold and silver bejeweled tomb of Tsongkhapa, the founder of the Yellow Hat sect, and many other interesting sites. That journey was far from being uneventful. Among other incidents, Yongdan, when wandering alone through the monastic city, met a man who had known us well for a long time. He of course inquired about me, and the Lama told him that I was still in China and that when his pilgrimage was over he would go back to me. Our old acquaintance then invited him to drink tea, but Yongdan declined, saying that he did not feel very well and would call on another occasion. He quickly rejoined me, and as, happily, we had finished visiting the various shrines and the country review the monastery, we made haste to leave the place. At Lhasa much tea and spirits had been drunk, but the two cases were still pending. A new period of festivities was soon to begin, and the judges had postponed the case until after these were over. This completely dispelled my fear, for I had decided to leave the day after the great Serpang pageant. But I had not yet finished with the comedies and dramas enacted by my curious neighbors. One night I was awakened by one of the open-air lodgers of the courtyard, an old woman who asked help for her daughter, who seemed to be about to die. Yongdan and I and the captain and his wife ran hastily outside. We found the girl seated. She appeared to breathe with difficulty and uttered strange sounds, a little like the noise of an engine letting off steam. I understand now, the mother told us. The god rides her. End of this part. Chapter 8. I left Lhasa as quietly as I had entered, and no one suspected that a foreign woman had lived there for 2 months. I looked somewhat different from the beggar I was when I first entered the Forbidden City. I had promoted myself to a more respectable station in the social hierarchy. I was now a middle-class woman, the owner of 2 horses and accompanied by a man-servant whom Yongdan had engaged at Lhasa. Official inquiries about travelers going from the capital to the frontiers are not very strict, so I could afford to make myself a little more comfortable. I had also purchased a quantity of books at Lhasa, and as the tour I was undertaking in the south of the country had, as its special object, the hunt for old manuscripts to add to the excellent Tibetan library I had collected on my previous journeys and which was safely housed in China, horses were needed to carry the luggage. As for myself, I had decided to continue to walk most of the time, finding it, now that I had no longer a load to carry, a most enjoyable sport. One sunny morning in spring I followed once more the wide street leading to the Potala, across gardens where trees were now gay with the fresh pale green garb of new leaves. I passed the gate of Norbu Ling, smiling at the idea that the ruler of Tibet, who lived there, little imagined that I had been so near to him for so long a time. He knew me personally, since we had met more than once in the Himalayas.